All right, we're in CLR world again. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Shurupa. I'm a program manager working on the Common Language Runtime team, and I've been on the team for about 4.5 years now.
Nice. So speaking of four, this is CLR 4 that I've been going around doing a lot of interviews, and you're responsible for something called targeted patching. What does that mean? What's going on?
So targeted patching just happens to be a feature that we've been working on for the code generator in the CLR. And the overall feature is about making engine images more resilient.
Okay.
And so engine images are what we, so we ship all managed code is shipped as MSIL, which is the format we ship them in. But you can either take the MSIL assemblies and generate code for them at runtime when the application is running, or you can engine them, which is this ahead of time compilation step.
Okay.
But the unfortunate thing is that these engine images, historically, they were more like taking the JITted code and all the runtime data structures, serializing them and persisting them in a file. And so they've never been resilient. So if you change any of the dependencies, or if you change the runtime, you would have to keep regenerating them.
Sure.
And so targeted patching has been our first attempt to make it so that you can install patches to the .NET framework or the CLR and still have the engine images be valid.
Interesting. So how does it work?
Can I draw
something? Of course.
Cool.
Drawing pictures is great.
So, assuming this is, let's say, Visual Studio Assembly. And so when you install Visual Studio, here's the IL assembly, and as part of installation, you get an engine image corresponding to it. And so this might be, so this is called the .ni.dll. So let's just call it Visual Studio Core.dll. And so you get a VS Core.ni.dll.
Okay.
And so this engine image, among other things, would depend on mscorelib.dll. And so in the past, when you updated mscorelib.dll, we would have to regenerate the image for vscore.ni.dll. And the challenge with that is not just the fact that it takes time to regenerate the engine image. So that is a big problem because you could have hundreds of these native images on your machine depending on how many managed applications you have. The other challenge, of course, is since it takes a while to regenerate them, while you haven't generated them, you fall back to jitting all of these images. And so most of the time when we are doing performance work, we assume that it's steady state and everything is pre-compiled. But right after servicing, you would enter into this mode where a whole bunch of assemblies might be jitting. And so it's not really the scenario that you've tuned the performance of your application for. And the way this works is this is a very small step, I would say. The thing that we have made engine images resilient to is that if you had some method M1 inside mscorelib, you can now change the body of this method. Like today, even if you recompile it without any changes, we just detect the fact that the assembly is different and we start rejecting this engine image at bind time. Now you can make these one-line method body changes and it wouldn't invalidate the engine image for VS Core. And among the things, so the time when we started to work on this, we started removing a bunch of dependencies that we had between one engine image and another. So, to give you an example, so this is mscorelib.ni.dll. So we used to have this feature in the runtime which we call hard binding, and it was built for performance reasons. So I think to some extent this is a trade-off between runtime performance and resilience to a large extent. So we've been doing a bunch of performance work to make it so that we don't take a perf hit for the most part. But we would have, say, a pointer. We used to have direct pointers from VS Core's engine image into the engine image of mscorelib. Mm. So one of the first things we did was that we removed these direct pointers. So instead, we now have these indirection cells which get populated at runtime.
Excellent.
And then among other things, you have metadata tokens inside mscorelib.dll. And so if VS Core depends on mscorelib, a particular method, say M1, it embeds M1's metadata token in the engine image. So we now have this tool that we are running as part of build which stabilizes this token. So it just means that if you change the body of M1 and recompile it, mm-hmm. Using the C# compiler, we guarantee that all existing types and methods get the same metadata token. Nice. And so this guy was relying on the token being something, and that invariant is maintained, even though you recompiled MSCoreLib from underneath.
Very nice.
So I'm sure you have questions. I just rambled.
Definitely. No, that's a great rambling. I mean, that makes it really clear. I mean, we can end now. I think it's clear. No, I'm just kidding. So, I mean, just to step back a second. So essentially what you're talking about, so if I've written an application in Visual Studio 2008 and I update to a service pack or the latest version, I'm safe. Or actually, if I get Dev 10, because this is the Dev 10
time. That's right. It would not work if you...
So let's move in the future. All right. So I've written a Dev 10 app, and you guys come out with a service pack. I don't have to ngen all my images again. So that's what you're saying. Is that guaranteed, or is it just a step in that direction?
So I would say it's a step in that direction. The reason being, it depends on the service pack. If the service pack is something like 3.5 SP1 with lots of changes, it's quite unlikely that the only kinds of changes you have are these method body changes. Yeah. So the things that we don't handle is, for example, if you added a new field, so say this was a method inside some type T. Mm-hmm. If you add a new field to the type T and it's not a sealed type, it just means that in VS Core, and so let's assume type T was an MS Core lib, in VS Core I could actually have type derived. And the layout of the objects of type derived mm-hmm. actually depend on the layout of type T. So if, for instance, during my service pack, I added a brand new field here, that impacts just the layout of objects of type derived. And so that's the kind of changes that we aren't resilient to.
Understood.
At least as a first step, that's not something that we support.
Understood.
But for QFEs, I think our major driving scenario has been GDRs, which typically are...
What is a GDR? People don't know.
I think it's General Distribution Release. Okay. And they're for critical security fixes, which we roll out to everybody who has, say, the .NET framework installed. Mm-hmm. And those are typically very targeted fixes, unlike service packs, which sometimes do have more than just targeted fixes. And for those, we do expect that you don't need to add new types or add new fields when you're making those targeted changes. And we did an analysis of all the QFEs that we've shipped out for .NET Framework 1 and 2, and we found that a majority, definitely more than half of them, had nothing but changes to method bodies. So for QFEs and GDRs, I think this will be very helpful. For service packs, if they're very targeted service
sure.
packs, maybe. But.
So, I mean, again, your customers that you're really talking about then are going to be sort of internal customers. Right. I mean, let's talk about, we have ISVs that are building these pretty large .NET applications. They're also going to be a customer of this or, you know.
Oh, I would actually say all end users are customers of this. Because today as an end user, you may have installed a bunch of managed applications. Let's say you've installed some application from Autodesk and you have Visual Studio Expression Blend.
Yeah.
And so the scenario this really applies to is the patch install scenario. And so today we have like high priority fixes like GDRs which get pushed out on your machine if you're opted into automatic updates. Mm-hmm. And then you end up having to regenerate. And it happens transparently, but we've seen people complain about the fact that the engine service has been running in the background for a while. What's going on? Mm. And so it is really targeted not just to internal developers, but to end users
True.
For using managed apps.
Excellent. So I guess what I meant by that were, you use the developer keyword. So if I'm an ISV that's built this application, this is going to be something that's going to benefit, obviously, my development and obviously customers in the end because they have less time. It doesn't have to get rejitted.
That is correct. So it helps me as the ISV because my application doesn't need to get re-engined every time Microsoft ships an update for the .NET framework.
That's awesome. That's really cool. And this is just the beginning, right?
That's right. We do want to support more kinds of changes.
So, I mean, there has to be some sort of, analysis that happens so that you know
that
you don't have to re-engine. So there is...
Yes. And so that is actually part, the tool I was alluding to earlier, which makes sure that all the metadata tokens are normalized. That tool... So maybe I can draw another picture.
Sure.
So essentially the idea is when you have your servicing tree where you're making these changes, you want to be able to compare against the previous build, like you said, and compare to see if the changes that you made are allowed or not, or we call them targeted patching compatible changes.
Okay.
And if it is compatible, then we have something called the targeted patching band information. And so if the band information was zero at RTM and the change you made is compatible, we keep the band information as zero. And if it's incompatible, so we're trying to work through some processes to make it so you inadvertently don't check in fixes which violate these constraints. But assuming that you have to introduce a new type, say, then you would update this band information to one. Mm. And this works completely transparently on the end user side, as in there are no changes to set up. The basic idea is engine itself now takes into account this band information. So previously, when, say, the CLR loader and binder was trying to load this particular vscore.ni.dll, today it actually checks all the things that this depends on. And one of them is mscorelib, and it says, oh, I see that the identifier for mscorelib has changed. Mm-hmm. And so it rejects this particular image. So we've now changed that logic to say, even if, and these identifiers are called mvids, even if the mvid has changed, if the band information is the same, then we say, oh, this image can actually be used at runtime. And we do a bunch of internal bookkeeping to make it so you don't have to keep repeating the check every time.
Good. Now, so, I mean, in some sense, if I have an application that was written before this greatness comes out, but I want to just compile my app, you know, if I've written in Visual Studio 2008, I compile it against the new CLR. Mm-hmm. I get this, of course, because I'm running in this context.
That is correct.
So this is actually a really good thing for people who do kind of frequent updates or, you know, not huge, giant things where they start changing the patterns or of their methods and whatnot, adding fields, etc. Okay, so this makes sense. What were some of the big challenges you guys ran into when building this?
So I think one of the challenges has been just we don't really have a shipping framework that operates on IL assemblies and rewrites them. Mm. So very recently, like Herman Venter made the CCI2 framework available on CodePlex.
Okay. He's a researcher in MSR.
That's right. He's a researcher in MSR. And I think CCI2 stands for, it's for Common Compiler Infrastructure
yes.
Version 2.
Yeah.
And so for a while, we were trying to figure out what's the best way for us, because these assemblies, essentially these are built, say, by the C# or the VB.NET compiler.
Mm-hmm.
And then we want to do this post-processing step on the generated assembly and add this band information, normalize all the metadata tokens. And then we also do want to do this analysis, which compares the old version against the new version. And it took us a while to figure out what was the best tool to use for that.
Mm.
I think the other challenge, of course, is that this needs to run during build. So it needed to be plugged into our build system.
Mm.
And before we even started thinking about this, we spent a lot of effort eliminating this hard binding feature and then getting the end-to-end system working without a huge performance loss. So the whole idea behind hard binding was that you could directly reference types and methods in a dependency. And so when you actually removed, when we actually removed this feature, it has significant impact on working set as well as to some extent on runtime performance as well. So we did a bunch of feature work to re-architect engine images, make it so that everything was still performant.
Sure.
After we removed this feature. So that was a big part of the effort, which was non-trivial to get right.
Of course. And, of course, you say, you know, the magic term re-architect. That, of course, has immediate implications for compatibility, right?
So hopefully. So one of the cool things is that so none of these are APIs. These are all internal runtime things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that doesn't mean that there cannot be any behavioral breaking changes. But this was just the infrastructure that generates the native image and the data structures that are persistent in the native image itself.
Absolutely. So let's go, you know, just for a refresher course, you know, in some sense, the jitter will run if if the loader, I'm assuming, or whatever at runtime doesn't detect that there's an NGen image present.
Mm-hmm.
It then calls up the jitter. So this is all transparent to the jitter. It's not like the jitter goes, oh, well, I'm going to look for, before I jit, I'm going to look for NGen.
That's right. It's actually done by the binder. You're completely
Of course. So the binder does that.
And so there was work in that, on that level as well, right?
That's right.
That's
and
where
so
the major
that was
logic
the work
is.
With the rewiring. That's right. That was the whole thing with checking the band information. That's all in the binder.
Cool. And this post-Suzanne Cook, huh? She's no longer here.
That's right. I've actually seen her Channel 9 interview.
Yeah.
We had, I think...
She was Miss Binder and Loader, right?
That's right.
Interesting.
We had a couple of years in common, I think, when I joined the team.
So what are some of the things you're thinking out, you know, without getting specific about it? Like, this is the first step. What's missing from the step? I mean, to me, is, you know, it sounds like it's pretty good. But what's missing?
Yes. So I think the overall problem, I think this is one part of a much bigger problem we've been trying to work on, which is about build lab compilation. Mm. So I think in managed code, one of the coolest things is developer productivity. Like, that's why people love managed code. Mm-hmm. But then there are some artifacts that people don't like so much. And one of them is, well, I want to be able to deploy my binaries, like I did with my C++ code. And the binaries that I sign and ship out of my company are exactly the things that run on all my end users' machines, which is not really the model that you have with any language that has that requires executing the code on a runtime and interpreting it or JIT compiling it or even pre-compiling it on the end user machine. And so for a while we've been trying to figure out, how do you get the best of both worlds? Is that even possible? And this all goes back to this fundamental fragile base class problem, which is what I was describing a little bit earlier, where you had a type in MSCoreLib, which had a bunch of fields, and then you had a derived type in some application assembly. And then when you change the base class, it actually invalidates the code that you had generated. And so one easy way to work around it, before we started thinking about fragility, it was never an issue because we generate the code dynamically. And so if it's changed, well, you get the new layout of the object in memory. But we've now slowly started walking in this direction where we want to have persisted binaries with like x86 or x64 machine code, which are resilient. And so we've started revisiting some of the problems that C++ had. Mm. And we don't want to give up on some of these cool features, which is one way to solve this problem is to say you can never derive. You can have derived classes, but they need to be in the same assembly, or they need to be in the same versioning bubble, so they all change together. And so how do we come to a place where we don't give up on the flexibility that we have with managed code, and yet not be in this place where you either always have to do JIT compilation, or you have this really fragile pre-compilation that happens on the end user machine?
Yeah.
And so I think we've broken the problem down into two parts, and one of them is time taken to pre-compile or engine and assembly. And then the other one is the number of assemblies to pre-compile. So this particular feature with targeted patching mostly addresses the second aspect, which is when something changes, how can I make it that if I change foo, I only need to regenerate the engine image for foo and not for anything else that depended on it. And then the other part of the problem, of course, is how do I reduce the time taken to generate the engine image for foo in the first place?
Sure.
And I think even after we extend targeted patching, there will be these fundamental kinds of changes, like adding fields and adding new virtual methods, which affect the actual data structures which get persisted in the engine image for the dependent module. And we don't really expect to make the engine images resilient to those sorts of changes.
Sure.
And so the other part of the problem that we're really trying to tackle is, in the situations when I have to regenerate the engine image for VS Core, how can I make that as fast as possible?
Absolutely. I mean, and what I would ask you is, in some sense, why would the engine be slower than the jitter? Because, of course, when you're jitting something at runtime, you better be as performant as hell, mm-hmm. right? And so if you engine it, in some sense, I mean, you're still creating x86 code from NSIL. So why is there a difference in speed? Why aren't you at JIT speed?
So it's actually not slower. It actually uses the JIT to generate the code.
Okay.
It's just so, which is why we decided to attack the number of assemblies. So it's a finite amount of time. Yeah. I think I mentioned C++ because there is no step that needs to happen on the user machine. And here there is a step.
Yeah.
And when you multiply it with the number of assemblies. So I think the reason why the servicing scenario is interesting is because when you're just installing VS, pre-compiling everything does take some time, but it's amortized because you only do it for the VS assemblies. The servicing scenario is particularly pathological because you change the base runtime and now you have to regenerate the engine images for all the apps.
Sure. Well, in some sense, that was a policy decision at the time, right? It's like a blue screen on Windows, right? So you have a driver, you start screwing around with memory, and so Windows decides by policy, uh-oh, you know, I don't know what to do about that. We don't want to have this really weird situation up in user mode. Mm-hmm. Let's reboot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what you guys do because the changes at that back in
correct.
Time.
Correct, and we are slowly revising some of the policies. And so one of the questions, of course, is how do we make it? So ideally, we would take these engine images and ship them.
Yeah.
And so, well, if they're completely resilient, then I can just go ahead and ship them. But because they aren't, shipping just means that, well, if I'm, let's say, expression blend,
yeah.
and I took my assemblies, pre-compiled them, and that's all I shipped, well, now I have to make sure that no matter what I do to change the .NET framework, those images are never invalidated.
Yeah.
Because you can be in a place where we're servicing something and expression blend needs to reship their app every time, like we ship a patch with the .NET framework.
Mm.
And since we aren't quite there yet, we are trying to figure out what we can do, if anything at all.
Excellent.
To improve this story.
Well, this is a great first step. And again, so what you're doing actually is you're just cracking open the NGen image and making changes inside of there.
That's
and saving
right.
it again, as opposed to actually going through the huge process to generate one. I mean, that's what's happening in the nuts and bolts level, right?
Oh, no, tell me more what you mean by that. I actually don't need to touch this NGen image at all.
At all.
That's right.
So, interesting. So what's actually... So that's... So basically I'm confused. So... If I have an NGen image that contains information that was it's basically the JITted x86 gook of my application,
mm-hmm.
right? And I go ahead and I do what you call a targetable change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what exactly happens? So you actually don't go into that image. If I added something to a method foo that was not of the type that you talked about where you couldn't do it, the
mm-hmm.
type derived,
mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that information have to live in the NGen image?
That's a great question. So actually, no. So the whole idea for having this tool that detects what's safe or not, it
yeah.
says something is safe when it knows that no artifacts of that particular change
yeah.
have leaked into, if I may use that term,
sure.
into this engine image. So this engine image, for instance, will contain a call to this particular method M1,
okay.
and the entry point to M1 hasn't changed. That was the reason why we wanted to make sure... say that the metadata token for M1 has not changed. But the actual body of the method exists in the engine image for MSCoreLib.
Okay.
And so MSCoreLib, of course, has to be re-engined because that's the assembly that changed. But at runtime, VSCore's engine image will still be calling M1 and then getting the new implementation with the bug fix.
Okay. Excellent. Very cool. So, I mean, this is all, of course, going to be transparent to everyone. I mean, it's not like, as you said, there's no APIs. That
That's right.
Can't
there's
start.
Nothing that you would need to do to get the benefits.
Totally.
From this.
But people should keep using NGen. I mean, it's
yes.
a great tool.
Right? Yeah, so I think so that brings me to the other part of something that we've been wanting to change for a while,
mm-hmm.
which is NGen isn't very easy to use today. It's this command line tool, and it's supposed to be run during installation, which means if you're using an MSI, you need to build some kind of custom action. So in terms of the things that we want to enable long term is to make NGen much easier to use. Like if we could make NGen automatic, that would be a very different story.
Absolutely.
It could still be opt-in, but it just means that the same binder, when it's giving us a particular IL assembly, if that has been marked by some fashion, we haven't quite figured out the details of that yet, saying that I should have an NGen image, then when the binder finds that, oh, I don't have an NGen image, and so we're going to fall back to JITting, well, maybe it can figure out how to build an NGen image in the background.
Mm.
But you wouldn't need to have a custom action that shells out calls to NGen.exe.
Sure.
And you need to be admin, and so you need to have a real installation experience in order to use NGen. If you're just doing this xcopy deployed app, there is no easy way to use NGen today.
That's interesting. I mean, because let's talk about the morphology of NGen then. I mean, it's just a file in reality
mm-hmm.
that contains a bunch of instructions.
That's right.
So in some sense, when I press compile in Visual Studio, You know, as a developer, I can make the decision, yeah, I mean, this is, I'm not relying on a bunch of dynamic types and whatnot, and I don't really know where dynamic types play into NGen in general. Uh-huh. But my point is, you know, it should just be sort of, I get it for free, and then I deploy my app, and when I create my installation package, it just goes, sucks in the file that I created when I compiled. Mm-hmm. But there obviously has to be intelligent reasons why it is a little bit more complicated, because it can't be that simple.
Yes, I think the primary one, of course, is that it's not that I run F5, I get the engine image, and I package that and ship it. That's part of the challenge. Mm-hmm. That's what we would want with the C++-style deployment. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge comes from the fact that you have to somehow generate, you don't ship them, you ship the IL assembly, and then you somehow have to generate these engine images when your end users are installing your application. And so that's where it comes down to, and since I don't have a way to really do that with an API call when the application is running, mm-hmm. well, it just means that I have to do something when my app is being provisioned on the end user machine, mm-hmm. Asking it to create these images. So that's where the challenge comes from.
I understand, because, I mean, there has to be sort of intelligence happening, or at least some sort of algorithms going on determining where I'm being installed. I mean, installation is a complex piece.
That's right, and over the years I've learned, and I don't work in setup, but since we do have NGen running during setup of the .NET framework, I've learned how complex it can be.
Excellent. And now for cases sort of like for a big, huge customer of you guys, one of the most widely used uses of the CLR in general is going to be ASP.NET, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly that's a big thing for web developers to get, not have to sit there and wait for JITs to happen. So for example, but that's a great example of sort of deployment in the future would be nice, right? In the sense that I don't have to JIT every single time.
That's an awesome example you bring up, because we've been having a lot of conversations about that. So that's actually been one of the driving scenarios for not having this custom action based, like shell out commands to engine.exe style of doing engine. Because if, for instance, you have an ASPX page, you can take that and precompile it into IL, and you should be able to precompile that and build the native images as well. And you certainly don't want to run some kind of admin or elevated tool in order to do that. Mm. And so one of the things that we've been looking to do is the automatic engine should make it so that even if you aren't an admin and you're just X-copying an app, you should be able to create these engine images. But today, if you look at engine, all the native images go under C, Windows, assembly, right next to the global assembly cache. So it's a machine-wide trusted location.
Absolutely.
And so it will be a major change to make it so that you can take your app local things and actually produce a native image somewhere and bind to it.
Awesome. Because, I mean, I know a lot of Niners kind of give our dev team a hard time sometimes, because when they make a change and they deploy, well, it requires a recompilation, right? A rejit. Mm-hmm. And that takes time. And so Niners are like, dude, why is the site so slow? And all you did was added a new feature here or there. But it's interesting. I mean, and if we do a service pack, fix bugs and stuff, there's another case where that happens. So this is going to be really bright for the future.
Cool.
Hey, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Great
Thanks
job.
For your time.
Of course.
Thanks a lot.
Right on.